So I'd like to introduce our speaker for tonight. John Wyatt is Emeritus Professor of Neonatal Pediatrics at University College London and a Principal Investigator at the Faraday Institute at the University of Cambridge. His background is as a pediatrician and neonatologist, caring for the sick and premature infants, and as a researcher into the prevention of brain injury in newborn babies. He is currently leading a multidisciplinary research project funded by the Templeton World Charity Foundation into the philosophical, religious, and social implications of the advances in artificial intelligence and robotics technology based at the Faraday Institute in Cambridge. And before, a very brief note before I continue, he's brought some of his books. So this is his most recent book, Matters of Life and Death. This is available for £10. And this one here, On the Right to Die, with a question mark and note, is available for £5. So please do take a look at those afterwards and purchase them if you're interested. Back to Dr. Wyatt. He has a long-standing interest in the ethical basis of medical practice and in the philosophical, religious, and social issues raised by advances in biomedical technology. He is frequently engaged in public and professional consultations and debates on ethical issues raised by medical advances and has given evidence to select committees of the UK Parliament on several occasions. And as I just mentioned, his book on medical ethics, Matters of Life and Death, Human Dilemmas in the Light of the Christian Faith, it's been translated into more than 10 languages, is available here. And his most recent book is Right to Die? Euthanasia, Assisted Suicide, and End-of-Life Care. And Dr. Wyatt, if you'd like to speak.
Great. Well, it's good to be here. So, as you've heard, my background is really from a clinical point of view, and it's really out of my clinical experience in neonatology and care of children that I then became increasingly interested in all issues to do with advances in technology and medical ethics, and particularly then thinking from a Orthodox Christian perspective. So I'm going to speak for about 45 minutes or so. I'm going to raise quite a lot of questions. I'm going to go fast and just over some of the technology, and then try and lay out some of what I see as the foundational issues and challenges, as well as maybe one or two Christian perspectives, but then hold have it open for debate and discussion. I mean, if you're kind of expecting some nice, slick answers to really complex, difficult problems, I'm afraid you're going to be deeply disappointed. But I do actually believe that these issues, some of these issues, as technology advances, are some of the most, are raising some of the most profound issues of what it means to be human. And I think the answers that we come to as a society are going to be incredibly important in the next decade, two decades, three decades, so on. And this is far too important to leave to the scientists. I think these issues do touch us all in many different ways. And one of the most important things is, of course, they touch us personally as well. So one of the issues we're talking about is reproductive technology and infertility. Statistics are that 1 in 6, 1 in 7 couples will have difficulty in conceiving and will need technology if they want to have a child. So I can guarantee there's at least one person, if not several people here, who are affected by infertility, even though you don't know it yet. Maybe more than you don't know it yet, but you will discover. And so you will actually personally face some of these issues about how, whether to use technology and what the moral basis of it is and so on. And in terms of genetics, again, it turns out that every single one of us is carrying alleles, genetic variations, which potentially could cause lethal genetic disease or profound life-altering disease, which may affect you in your life, which you may pass on to your children, and so on. So these are far more than just interesting philosophical, theological issues. They're deeply personal issues which touch us all as well. So my background is as a baby doctor caring for tiny little sick, some of the extremely preterm babies going right down to the limits of viability. That's out of a normal 40-week gestation. We care for babies down to 24 weeks, 23 weeks, 22 weeks. Smallest baby I ever cared for who survived was 21 weeks, 6 days. Babies weighing 500 grams, literally fitting in the palm of my hand. we invest a huge amount of technology trying to help these little babies to survive. That's my hand, I wouldn't want to play maybe some baby in it. And it costs something like £1,500 per baby per day to care for these tiny little preterm babies. And the total cost of ensuring the survival of an extremely preterm baby is £50,000 to £100,000. All paid for in the UK by the NHS, free of at the point of need. So clearly, as a society, we believe that these tiny little beings are worth, are valuable to be invested in, are significant and oppressed. And I have devoted 20 years of my life into trying to ensure some of these tiny babies survive. And yet, just one floor away in the same hospital is the fetal medicine unit. Again, highly sophisticated area, very technologically based, where pregnant women, I work in central London at University College London, I have done, I'm no longer doing the hands-on clinical stuff, and pregnant women from a wide area of London and the southeast of England are referred to the fetal medicine unit if an abnormality of the fetus is detected before birth. Sophisticated investigations, ultrasound like this, amniocentesis, where the fluid around the baby is removed and analysed, and then detailed investigations, very frequently this particular chromosomal anomaly is found. So this is a little girl, these are chromosomes obtained before birth. We know she's a little girl because she's got two X chromosomes rather than X and Y, but she's got an additional 21 chromosome. So we know that she's going to develop Down syndrome. Can't tell from the chromosomes how severe, what the implications would be. It could be life-threatening, very severe, it could be relatively mild. But in the UK, every time this is diagnosed before birth, the mother will be offered an abortion, whatever the stage of the pregnancy, including even in really quite advanced pregnancies. And I wonder if you could guess what percentage of mothers in the UK, if this particular chromosomal pattern is diagnosed, what percentage would vote, would have, choose to have an abortion?
Over 90.
It is about 90, yeah, 91, 92%.
So at any stage of the pregnancy?
At any stage of the pregnancy.
But it's like also very risky, this late pregnancy.
So, it's a little known fact in the UK, the law allows abortion to be carried out for so-called medical reasons at any stage in the pregnancy all the way until term. And although the numbers are small, in my own hospital in central London, abortions are quite regularly carried out at 24 weeks, 26 weeks, 28 weeks, 32 weeks, even 36 weeks. The technique that's used is to inject a needle into the baby's heart under ultrasound guidance and inject lethal poison to stop the heart. And it's a procedure which I'm afraid is carried out quite regularly. And it's what the curious, painful thing is that on many occasions I've been called up one floor from the baby unit where we're struggling to save the life of a tiny premature baby. I've gone up one floor to talk to a mother who's considering having an abortion, who wants to talk to a paediatrician. And the baby in her womb is considerably bigger and tougher and stronger than the one who's struggling to say, I'm one floor down. And then you say, how is it possible in one hospital, in one medical system, to have these two apparently contradictory activities going on? The other bizarre thing is that, going back to the diagnosis of Down syndrome, the amniocentesis technique, in order to make this diagnosis, you need to do an amniocentesis. The amniocentesis technique itself carries the risk of causing miscarriage. And you can calculate that for every one baby detected with Down syndrome, between one and two healthy babies will die as a result of the testing procedure. And so here we seem to be saying that it's actually more important to jeopardize the lives a healthy unborn baby in order to detect whether or not a baby has Down syndrome. And this slightly busy slide this is year going from 1990 to 2005. The blue line is the total number of diagnoses of Down syndrome before birth. It's rising quite significantly with time, and that's basically because of maternal age. As mothers get older, the risk of Down syndrome increases. The red line is the number that will be born alive if there was no antenatal diagnosis. And the green line is the number of actual babies born with Down syndrome. So this difference between these two lines represents babies who die, who are basically aborted. The babies with Down syndrome who should be part of society, but who have been aborted. And it's, as you can see, it's of the order of 500 or so in each of those periods. So there is, in fact, a sort of quite a sophisticated industry which is devoted to trying to identify abnormal babies before birth so that abortion can be offered. And in the UK, this is a nationwide screening program. It's not compulsory. You can opt out of it, but in fact, it's very difficult to opt out. There is a very strong communal pressure coming from the health professionals often that it's quite irresponsible of you to opt out of this. And it's interesting that fetal screening as a technology raises all these things. Whenever you have a technology, it raises issues of efficiency, cost effectiveness, quality control, uniformity. How effective are we at identifying? This is the rate of detection against different medical conditions. Some conditions can be detected antenatally with very high, virtually 100% effect. Other conditions are lower, and you can see how can we increase diagnostic accuracy? How can we make sure that we detect every condition before birth? It's not surprising that industry has quite a psychological. And one of it is the medicalization of pregnancy. That pregnancy becomes so much more medicalized when people are given diagnoses, they're given a risk. You have a 1 in 180 chance of having some rare syndrome. You go onto the internet, you read up about it's a horrific, degenerative, rare neurological condition. And then how do I cope with 1 in 180 risk? Well, I could have an amniocentesis and rule it out, but then the amniocentesis itself carries a risk of killing the baby. Can I live with the 1 in 180 risk? Is that a big risk? Is it a small risk? Should I go and see another medical expert? Can I get the test done privately? And so this whole sort of medicalization, implicit pressure to engage in antenatal testing, anxiety. I mean, for me, it's one of the saddest things is that in the pre-technological era, most people's experience of pregnancy was an enjoyable thing. It was something that you really enjoyed, looking forward to meeting your baby. Something you knew about your baby, but you just looked forward to it. Now, the effect of technology is so often to raise really quite horrific fears of rare and horrible conditions, and then anxiety about how I respond, what I should do, and all those painful choices, as I've said, about anesthesia. Difficulty in comprehending and evaluating risk. It's interesting that a lot of psychological studies about how human beings cope with risk, and it seems basically that we have rules of thumbs about how we cope with risk, and we basically divide things into which are really quite likely and things which are very rare. So it's quite likely that it'll rain tomorrow, and we sort of understand what quite likely means. And my chance of getting hit by a car as I cross the road outside is very rare. And I can just about cope with those two understandings. But what does 1 in 75 risk mean? Is that we don't, or 1 in 12, or 1 in 328? What does that actually mean? How do I live with that? How do I understand what that is? It's actually remarkably difficult psychologically. And then, a number of sociologists have pointed out, one particular who was called Nancy Rothman, that the paradoxical effect of fetal screening is to cause a pregnant woman to distance herself emotionally from the child she carries. And she called this the tentative pregnancy. So it's quite common for people not to tell anybody they're pregnant until they've had all the investigations, because it would be so difficult to have to explain to people that you'd had an abortion, and it's much better. And you don't want to become emotionally involved with this being in my womb until I'm absolutely certain that I'm going to carry on the pregnancy. Because, and so the very existence of the technology causes distancing. It's interesting how, therefore, the unintended consequences of technology can be very profound. And you may think all that is very difficult. It's about to get a whole lot worse. And that's because of this phenomenon, which is called non-invasive prenatal diagnosis. It turns out that in every pregnancy, in the maternal's bloodstream, a small quantity of fetal DNA is circulating. This is just a normal phenomenon. And it's now the technology has been developed, which means that from a simple blood test taken from a pregnant mother, you can separate out the fetal DNA and then effectively get a complete sequencing of the fetal genome. And at the moment, this is still a research procedure, but there's little doubt that it's coming and that it will, the cost will decrease. And it may well be seen as a responsible way forward. So, you know, fast forward 5 or 10 years, you or your partner or your daughter is pregnant, everything's very happy, it's a long-term pregnancy, she goes to see the clinic, they say, we just do the simple blood test, make sure everything's all right. You go back and say, well, we've got some news for you, you're carrying a little girl, congratulations. But unfortunately, there's a 60 to 70% chance that she's going to develop breast or ovarian cancer before the age of 50. There's an increased risk of type 2 diabetes and also a raised incidence of early onset Alzheimer's disease. Now, do you think it would be responsible to bring this baby into the world? Do you think that would be a loving, wise, responsible act? Or do you think it would be better to have an abortion and another go? And so you can just imagine the sort of agonies and perplexities and worries that this new information is going to bring. So it's almost as though technology is giving people, is giving us information about ourselves and about our children, which previously only God himself knew. The fact that we were likely to die from a particular kind of cancer and so on. And the problem is, God-like knowledge leads to God-like responsibility. So once we have this knowledge, how do we cope with it? How do we? Does humanity have the ability, either the psychological, the moral, the spiritual ability to cope with the kind of knowledge which genetic technology is giving us? Some people are very gung-ho about it. Actually, that's not the quote I meant. But this quote is saying that currently in the United States, women need not provide any reason for choosing to terminate a pregnancy. So it's difficult to justify restricting abortion in the case of a well-defined reason such as genetic disease. In other words, if parents wish to undertake genetic sequencing and then decide for whatever reason to have an abortion, in a liberal framework, it's not possible to say, no, you can't. Some people are predicting that this kind of whole genome screening done on the embryo will become routine to allow people to select the best child and as a form of control. So there are profound ethical and moral challenges here as technology advances, as well as all the psychological and social consequences. And it's interesting that genetics is seen as a way of understanding ourselves, a way of understanding what it means to be human, a form of self-transcendence. How can I understand myself? Answer, perhaps, by if I only can understand what these 3 billion letters in my genome actually mean, and how my letters are different from your letters, then I'll thoroughly understand who I am. And so direct-to-customer genetic testing is just taking off. This is something called 23andMe. Genetics just got personal. Let your DNA help you plan for the important things in life. And so the subliminal message, not that subliminal, is that every responsible parent will do the responsible thing to check their child's genetic inheritance and then plan on that basis in terms of their strengths and their weaknesses and their vulnerabilities and all the rest. It's also interesting that it's an interesting theme in the history of medicine and science is that human beings have always used the most advanced science and technology as a way of understanding the human body. So in the ancient Greeks, if reality consists of earth and fire and wind and water, well, it's obvious that the body is going to be composed out of earth and fire and wind and water. And so when you have a fever, that's because you have too much fire. And when you're swelling up with edema and fluid distension, that's because you've got too much water. And you have too much wind. Work that one out. And then in the 19th century, the is an age of hydraulics. And lo and behold, it turns out the human body is composed of a profoundly sophisticated hydraulic system. And there's circulation of fluids, and there's pressure differentials, and there are hydraulic mechanisms. In fact, some people have suggested the whole Freudian psychodynamic model is basically hydraulics applied to psychology. You know, there is an incompressible fluid and it's building up, it's libido, and then it comes bursting out in various forms. You know, this is just hydraulics. Well, here we are in an age surrounded by information processing machines, and guess what? The human body is an information processing machine. It has a sort of software, and this software, there are code readers, and this code is then analyzed, and basically inside every cell is a bit like a hard drive. And so you can just see how these very powerful metaphors are used, and that's how genetics taps into this cycle. It makes such total sense that this is information. There is information held within our genome, and it's the information that makes me who I am. So, talking about abortion and prenatal screening and so on, and this is really, although it's a new twist, it's really a new twist on an age-old ethical challenge, which is about the destruction of human life, taking human life, abortion, infanticide, and end of life, euthanasia, suicide. But it's the interesting thing about these things is they've been around for 2,000 years. The early church wrestled with them. And they are still very major issues and challenges, but they're not new. What is new are, and it's a bit slick, but it's the making, the shaping, and the faking of life. It's not the taking of life, it's the making, shaping, and faking. So making is reproductive technology and the new genetics, synthetic life, all that stuff. Shaping is the manipulation of human life, the enhancing, and the faking of human life is, as you heard, some of the stuff I got interested in, AI and robotics and simulation and so on. And the interesting things about these things is they are genuinely new and we don't have any tradition, speaking from a Christian point, how on earth we grapple with any of this. This is, and it's coming like a huge great wave. And I'm very concerned that we don't have the philosophical, theological nous to be able to cope with what are genuinely new problems. At the same time, I actually believe, speaking from a Christian point of view, that these are extraordinary opportunities to understand in a new way the faith wants to live to the saints. So one of the interesting things about Christian history is that it's so often in engagement and often conflict with, quotes, heresy, with new and challenging ideas, that Orthodox Christians have discovered new depths and profundities in Orthodox Christianity, Christian theology. And I suspect that we have more profound theology to develop about what it means to be human, what a human person is, what providence, God's providence in the composition of human, that means through genetics, and what it means to be a parent, and so on. All these phenomena, potentially, I think we have new insights to gain from the very challenge provided by this technology. When I was a medical student, which was an awful long time ago, back in the 1970s, I went to a lecture on human reproduction, and I discovered how to make a baby. And basically what I learned was that a man and a woman had to have sexual intercourse, and 9 months later a baby came out, and I wrote it all down very carefully in my notebook. Well, I had actually worked that out before I went to medical school. But if you were to go to a similar lecture now, how to make a baby in 2016, this is what you would learn. You need a source of eggs, you need a source of sperm, you need a uterus, a womb, and you need somebody who's going to care for the baby after birth. And so it's perfectly possible for any baby to have three mothers: a genetic mother who provides the egg, a carrying mother who provides the womb, and a social mother who actually cares for the child after. So there's no reason why any of these four constituents should have any relationship between them, so you can have surrogate pregnancy, egg donation, and so on and so on. And what that means is that it's opened an extraordinary vista on the possibilities of making a baby. And not so long ago, the New York Times had a story about a lady called Amy who wanted to have a baby. She wasn't in a relationship, she didn't fancy being pregnant, but she desperately wanted to have a baby. She thought, you know, wouldn't it be wonderful to have a baby? This would really fulfill my lifestyle. And so she went onto the internet. And first of all, she tried to find a sperm donor. Well, there are lots of sperm banks available on the internet commercially. This is the California Cryo Bank. I just took one at random. And you'd be pleased to know that graduate donors are here. Select hair color, eye color, ethnic origin. And then at random, I drilled down. So this was donor 11194. At 6'3", 203 pounds, donor 11194 towers over the competition. He's a charmer with blue eyes, blonde hair, a friendly smile. They even have donor lookalikes, and you'll be pleased to know that this one looks like Prince William. So you can select your celebrity and then choose to have to make a baby. And then it all gets a bit tacky because there are vials available to purchase. So you give your credit card details, and then courtesy of Federal Express, a neat little, we hope, unlabeled parcel. And then you need to find an egg donor. Well, donating eggs is much more invasive and potentially dangerous compared with sperm. And therefore, the value of eggs can run into thousands of dollars. And I hear that it's not unusual for women in the States to fund their way through college by basically donating eggs. And again, there's a market value. And I wonder if you can guess, just as a bit of light relief, if you can guess which eggs are most valuable when it comes to market value, what the donor's characteristics would be.
Beauty.
Beauty, yes. Anything else? Sorry?
Health.
Health, yes.
Blonde,
yes.
Young,
yes.
White,
yes. Several more characteristics. Peak value.
Educated.
Yeah, how educated?
Very educated.
Such as? Graduate. Doctorate at least. No, graduate. Oh, come on. So doctorate at least. Yeah, two more. Three more. Tall, athletic, and musical. So if you hit all of those, your eggs are really valuable. If you're short, dark, and into chess, I'm afraid. So it's a sort of nightmarish vision of the future where all the men look like Prince William and all the women look like Barbie doll with a PhD. So you select your eggs and then you you have to find a surrogate mother. Now, surrogate mothers, again, are not that easy to find, but you can find them, and this is a surrogacy consultant. I chose this one because this one is based in Delhi, and in fact, most surrogates are from poor countries, India, Southeast Asia, the old Soviet Union, Eastern Europe, and this is what's called now reproductive tourism. As we speak, embryos are being ferried across the world and being from rich Western countries and being implanted into the wombs of poor women. Often it's their only way of caring for their own existing children is by agreeing to be a surrogate mother. There have been all kinds of scandals about how the abuse of surrogate mothers and what happens if the baby is disabled or abnormal and all this kind of stuff. One of the reasons why they use poor countries is not just because it's cheaper, but also because in many rich Western countries, the law protects the rights of surrogate mothers, so surrogate mothers can't be forced to hand over their children. Whereas in many of these countries, the law says that it is the commissioning person who owns the baby, and therefore the surrogate mother has no rights. Going back to the story of Amy, what happened was these are actually the twins who were created in this way, and this was actually the surrogate mother. She was using a Westerner, and then the surrogate mother found out that Amy, who was before she handed the babies back to Amy, that there was a medical history, and that she felt she wasn't fit to be a mother. She refused to hand the babies over. Then there's a massive court case. Amy has spent tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars having these babies. Who do they belong to? Now, this is an extreme case, but it just illustrates how technology has changed the nature of parenthood. And that it's possible to do extraordinary things with reproductive technology. Gender selection. So gender selection is technically against the guidelines in the UK, but it's not unusual for a British couple to travel to Greece, create an embryo in Greece, to use gender pre-implantation diagnosis to choose the right gender, have the right embryo implanted, then come back to the UK and have your baby through the NHS.
Which is the right gender.
Well, that's exactly. So, in fact, in the West, most people, it's pretty equal. But of course, there are many other areas around the world where there is an incredibly strong social pressure to have boys. And so studies have shown that in many other countries outside the West, this technology is being used to ensure that boys are being conceived. And of course it's possible for single parents, same-sex couples. This is Sir Elton John and his male partner and their two children created with a surrogate mother. So it's interesting how these different factors in our society. Consumerism says I want to have the perfect baby, I want the baby to be like this and this, this. Relativism says, well, why not? What's wrong with it? As long as it's properly controlled and regulated, and who are we to say that you mustn't do that? And then technology says, well, we can make it happen. I think another factor in all this, which is very rarely discussed, but I think actually it's very important, and that is there are huge vested interests behind all this technology. So why is it that our newspapers are so frequently covered wall to wall with some wonderful breakthrough in technology? And it's a particularly British way of doing all this, and basically it's done by small numbers of the elite, behind closed doors, stitching up the plan for how to ensure the promotion of this kind of technology. And it involves a small number of elite scientists, because here is a prospect of getting our Nobel Prize and raising vast millions of grant funding. Elite funding agencies who find, you know, this is their way of supporting work that leads to a Nobel Prize and help we'll get our name all over the industry. Then you have biotechnology companies and venture capitalists who see there's enormous financial potential of some of this new a technology, biomedical technology. Then you have politicians saying, what we really want is we don't want all this work going to South Korea and China. What we want to make is UK PLC, the centre of this work. We want to attract the best scientists, we want to attract the best funding. That means we must have a liberal regulatory framework. We must make it as easy as possible for this work to be done here. We must remove restrictions. We must ensure that we have a really liberal regulatory framework. And then finally, you get a whole bunch of science journalists and documentary makers who also are highly interested in the possibility for promoting their interests and their career by promoting this science. And so you get these groups all come together, and lo and behold, our newspapers are filled with great breakthroughs that Britain is doing. And at one stage, we had the most, it was us and North Korea, we're really the only, the two most liberal places when it came to doing research on the embryo. And it's interesting that there's never really been any proper democratic debate. Why is most of this illegal in Germany, for instance? And yet, it's open season in the UK. The answer is pretty obvious. Historical roots back to the Nazis and so on has made Germany so much more concerned about protecting vulnerable human life. Whereas Anglo-Saxon empiricism, they really can't get too excited about small bunches of cells. So, you know, there are interesting and deep factors here. I'm interested to talk about some of that if you're interested in the new thing that's come along is this concept of embryo editing. And this is because of some sophisticated new genetic technology, which is called CRISPR-Cas9, which is pretty much why it's called that. But it's an extraordinarily powerful technique. And what it means is that out of a genome of any living being, virtually, but including human beings, in human beings, the genome has 3 billion base pairs. And using this technology, it's perfectly possible to identify one out of 3 billion, go to exactly the place, chop out one letter, and insert another letter back. Do it with astonishing accuracy and the ease. You can sit in the lab and design these things, and they happen. So this is really changing. It's a complete game changer in terms of what you can do with embryos, including what you can do with human embryos. And at the moment, this has not been this is actively being carried out in a number of places, primarily in China. There is a whole lot of ethical debate now about whether it should be allowed in human embryos here. At the moment, the regulations are that you shouldn't, as an embryo can't live more than 14 days in the UK, and it has to be destroyed and mustn't be put back into, if it's been experimented on, it mustn't be put back into the womb. But there is going to be growing pressure to say you could use this technique to cure horrific genetic diseases by chopping out in the embryo the abnormal bit of the genome and slicing back the normal bit. And there's going to be very strong pressure to say, no, this is, we should do this. But then there are also radical voices out there saying that actually if we're capable of making our children better, then we actually have a moral duty to do it. So John Harris, secular philosopher, do we have a moral duty to enhance our children if it's possible? And the answer is yes. If there are rational reasons to believe that technical enhancement of our children will bring greater happiness into their lives, then there is a moral duty on us to enhance them. And to choose not to enhance our children is morally equivalent to choosing an intervention to make them disabled. So if you knew you could make your child more intelligent, smarter, more resilient to disease, and you chose not to, then that's, as far as he's concerned, within his secular utilitarian framework, just moral equivalent to whether you would deliberately damage your child. And there are a number of people who tried to make secular arguments against this. There's a Michael Sandel, well-known philosopher at Harvard, who's written this book, which if you're interested, it's an interesting read, The Case Against Perfection, where he tries to put the argument that we should accept our children as in a gifted way. He sidesteps the question of who they are gifted by and what giftedness means, but you know, we accept our children as a given. This is my standout. In order to grapple with the ethics of enhancement, we need to confront questions largely lost from view, questions about the moral status of nature, about the proper stance of human beings towards the given world. Since these questions verge on theology, modern philosophers and political theorists tend to shrink from them, but our new powers of biotechnology make them unavoidable. The danger is that these technologies represent a kind of hyper-agency, Promethean aspiration to remake nature, including human nature, to serve our purposes and satisfy our desires. The problem is not, and I think this is a great sentence, it's worth remembering, the problem is not the drift to mechanism, but the drive to mastery. What the drive to mastery misses and may even destroy is an appreciation of the gifted character of human powers and achievements. The interesting thing is that in the sort of secular philosophical debate, Sandel has been roundly trashed by a large number of secular philosophers who just say, yeah, well, what is this? It's just arm and wing. What is this gift? Who is this gift? Is a baby with spina bifida a gift? Who is this who's giving this gift? And so on. Some years ago, the entire sequencing of the human genome was announced, and it's what I found fascinating. Well, again, there was wall-to-wall coverage in the broadsheets and BBC and so on. What I found fascinating was the quasi-religious tones in which it was announced. It was opening the Book of Life, the miracle of DNA, and the Times said it was a new beginning in which we finally accept that we are our own creators and that we alone have the power to make a better world. And I'm sure you know this picture, Michelangelo, the roof of the Sistine Chapel, and it's the description of the creation of Adam, and God is creating animal. Not so long ago, The Economist magazine had a front page, and there is Adam, only in deference to modern sensibilities, he has a laptop strategically positioned, which Michelangelo didn't seem to worry about. But the interesting thing is, of course, there is no God, there is no creator. Because Adam is now the creator. And Adam is making life. It says artificial life, the stuff of dreams and nightmares has arrived. But inside it said, we are as gods, so we might as well get good at it. And so this extraordinary narrative about man come of age, about that we now finally take grasp on the realities of biology, and we can now recreate ourselves. We're no longer at the mercy of evolutionary random forces. It's a very, very potent myth, a modern myth. And I think technology is a much more complex and mysterious thing than we often think. You know, the simple understanding of technology is about tools, functions, is very naive and limited. And actually, this is George Grant, who was now dead, but a remarkable Catholic Canadian philosopher who wrote about technology, and he said it's in the very name technology, it's a neologism of techne and logos, and it's the interpenetration of making and knowing, orientated towards the mastery of nature, both non-human nature and human nature. So it's that same thing, it's about mastery and how we master our own nature through technology. Now, there are interesting voices being raised in caution, secular voices, and this is The Guardian. Prudence demands that we marshal the full force of democracy to imagine the lives we want. Otherwise, we will find ourselves governed by technologies whose implications we did not foresee and whose development we chose to neglect. So there is this feeling that this amazing rush of technology is raising issues about the future of humanity and the future of society. It is clear that these technologies have enormous therapeutic potential, but they also carry within them this instrumentalization, the manipulation, particularly of vulnerable human lives. And C.S. Lewis, writing at the end of the Second World War in this very town, was writing about nature, in the abolition of man. Man's power over nature turns out to be power exerted by some men over other men. I think that's a very profound insight, but whenever you hear about power over nature, you need to think about the human power structures. And surprise, surprise, so often, highly sophisticated new technology is reinforcing ancient power structures. So often it's white, privileged men, rich men, who are using the technology to enforce and protect their own power dominance. And it's the weak, and it's the non-West, and it's women and it's children who are ultimately suffering. So some underlying issues for discussion. And where do you start? I mean, there's a whole sort of library of issues here. So, but clearly the moral status of embryonic humans, there is genetic determinism and the reification of genetic information. There's this fallacy of taking what is basically an abstract concept of a genetic code and turning it into some kind of ultimate meaning of that dominates who I am. There's procreation in the context of human relationships. Is it appropriate that a single person can make a baby? Or, as in the biblical framework, is it arguable that the procreative and the unitive aspects of marriage should be held together? And that making love and making babies belongs together? It's interesting ideas about parental love. Parental love has two aspects. Those of you who are parents will know that there is always some tension between accepting your children as they are, accepting that this is the way my child is, which is accepting love, and longing to transform your child, not to leave them the way they are, but to help them to grow and develop and change. Interesting, if you're a Christian, you can see the same thing in God's parental love for us. That God, both his love for us, both accepts us as we are and refuses to leave us where we are. What is interesting is that in technology, advances in reproductive technology and genetic technology, is that transforming love obliterates accepting love. In other words, I am not prepared to accept my child with all the genetic problems and deficiencies. I am going to transform them, I'm going to change them, necessarily I'm going to destroy this child and have another child. So transforming love overwhelms. And this is the tiger mother and the plus technology is a pretty lethal combination of this dominating, transforming love. There's this whole technology and the mastery of human nature. There are justice issues and the common good. How do we use biomedical technology to support justice? And then there's issues about technology, human enhancement. 5 minutes more, if you'll give me, just for some Christian headlines. I think Christian ethics, the way we treat one another, comes from Christian anthropology, the way we're made. And I think what that means is that creation theology, a rich and profound creation theology of what it means to be human, is absolutely essential. And actually, I suspect that this is at the root of a lot of the weakness of traditional Christian responses in this kind of area. It's because we have a very weak creation theology, a very underdeveloped creation theology, and therefore our understanding of what it means to be human in terms of the created order is impoverished and unable to respond to these remarkable challenges. There are metaphors. What does it mean to be a human being? Is there a difference between a human and an animal? Are we just primates with a bit of extra cerebral cortex? Are we just machines? What's the difference between the human brain and a computer? In the field of AI, there are people like Marvin Minsky that says a human is just a computer made out of meat. And But I think a very important concept is that to use a metaphor is not the same as to explain something. So you can say that the human brain is a bit like a computer. But that's totally different from saying it is a computer made out of meat. So I think so often scientists use metaphors as a way of explaining. As we said about, you know, the genetic code is a bit like a hard drive and it's got a program in it and so on. It's a metaphor. And metaphors can be helpful, but they do not help us with ontology or something else. And in Christian thinking, human beings are not self-explanatory. You don't derive our meaning by understanding ourselves. We actually derive our meaning from outside ourselves. We are derivative. Of course, this to the secularist is utterly outrageous and offensive. Because surely I must be able to understand my own meaning by analysing myself. And this is a lot of the quest, both for genetics, for artificial intelligence, for neuroscience. It's all in the hope that I will ultimately understand myself. And the extraordinary thing is that Christianity says we're not self-explanatory because we are derivative. We are made in the image of some other being. We actually reflect the reality of some other being. And therefore you'll never understand what it means to be human unless you understand that we are images, that we are derivative, that our meaning is derived ultimately from the being and character of ourself. And therefore we only make sense in the light of our creation in God's image. The significance and value of individual human life comes not from our function or from our abilities, but from the stuff of our being, from the way that God has called us into existence. And just an analogy, which like all analogies is limited, but it seems to me that there is still helpfulness in this analogy, that human beings are basically like flawed masterpieces. So this is actually a painting by Holbein called The Ambassadors. One of the Dutch masters. It's several hundred years old. It's in the National Gallery, and as you can see, it's suffered a lot of damage. And yet, despite the damage and the flaws and the imperfections, you can still see that it's a masterpiece. It's got a unique inherent value. And the art restorers got to work. And art restorers have a code of ethics, just like doctors do. And the code of ethics of art restorers says that you must find the original artist's intention, and then all your restorations have to be in line with the original artist's intention. And so they use sophisticated technology. This is X-ray diffraction technology. They see the multiple ways it's being painted. They work out what Holbein was attempting to achieve. And then they use highly sophisticated technology and artificial paints, gloss, and repatching the pigment. And if you were to go to the National Gallery now, this is what you would see. But the interesting thing is that the art restorers are not allowed to change the design. So the issue for an art restorer is not the technology, it is what you are using it for. And of course, the analogy when it comes to medicine is the difference between restorative therapy and enhancing therapy. Restorative therapy is basically restoring back to what the original creation order. Enhancing therapy is actually changing creation order. So, for instance, take it to reproductive technology. You can argue that if a couple who are married and committed to one another, a heterosexual couple, God's plan was that their love, their unique love, should be converted physically and incarnated in the form of a baby. Because the woman has particular biological problems, blockage of the fallopian tubes or whatever, that love is not able to translate into making a baby. If you then use highly sophisticated technology to take an egg from the mother, from the woman, and sperm from the man, you combine them in the laboratory, you create an embryo, you implant the embryo back in that mother's womb, and she is able to have a baby. I think you can argue that that is restorative therapy. That is restoring the original design. But if you take an egg from California Cryobank, sperm from Karo Bank, an egg from somewhere else, you put it in a surrogate mother in India, then you are fundamentally changing the design. That is changing the creation order. And I would then argue so that. So now, of course, there are all kinds of problems with the distinction between enhancing and restorative therapies. But I still think that it's a distinction which has some fundamental merit. And it'd be interesting to discuss that further. Let's close with this story. This is a very close friends of ours from some years ago, a couple in our church in London, central London, married, longing for their first baby. Then the news came through, she was pregnant, she was absolutely delighted. We had a celebration meal, and then they had various scans, they had genetic testing. It turned out the baby had a horrific genetic malformation called Edwards syndrome, which is universally lethal. And in this situation, what possible reason is there to carry on the pregnancy? And why go through it? Why put the baby through it? Why? Surely the moral, compassionate thing to do is to have an abortion. And after a lot of agonizing, Alan Verity said, "This is the baby that God has given us. We must love this baby, whatever is going to happen." And little baby Christopher was born, and he had all the signs of Edwards syndrome. He had severe brain malformations, heart malformations, so on. To everyone's surprise, he didn't die straight away, and they were able to bring him home. And they used to bring him along to All Souls Church where I go, where he became like a sort of mini celebrity. And everybody wanted to cuddle him. And he used to get passed from arm to arm and cuddled half to death. And everybody knew about baby Christopher. He was only 2.5 kilos, 5 pounds, but he was the smallest member of the church family, but was like this mini celebrity that everybody knew about and talked about. In fact, he lived for 7 months, and he got weaker and weaker and weaker, and eventually passed away quite peacefully in his dad's arms. And there was a memorial service at All Souls, and over 400 people came to pay tribute to baby Christopher. When he died, he was still 5 pounds, 7 months later. And one of the Alan Averis' friends said, "You know, Christopher couldn't grow, but he helped other people to grow." And it was true. I was one of the people whose lives were touched, and many others were as well. So, in other words, God is so often revealed not in the perfect specimens of humanity. We see the image of God, not necessarily in the Nobel Prize winner and the Olympic athlete, but we see God reflected in the broken and the weak and the vulnerable and the less than perfect. And of course, this is all about the Easter mystery, that ultimately God is revealed in the broken and bleeding body of a human being on a cross. So I like this quote with this, close with this, from Joseph Piper. "Christian love is a way of saying to another, it's good that you exist. It's good that you exist."